Good morning and welcome to a special edition of Speak Out here on this Wednesday. I'm Kevin Shepherdson, and we have a special one for you. It's the Havasu Pioneer Hour here on Speak Out, and Dan DeLosantos is here. Hi, Dan. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Kevin. I sure appreciate everybody listening in today. We got a lot of responses online, people that were waiting to hear this show. And so get ready. We've really got some great guest speakers to share with you today. We've got Michael McCulloch, representing the McCulloch family and the family holdings, and going to tell us a little bit of history today. And we've also got an individual that was there at the dedication and helped put in the time capsules. We also have a couple of residents that were here before the London Bridge. So let's start off with Michael McCulloch. And Mike, I want to thank you very much for calling in today.
Well, thank you, Dan. Thanks for having me.
We, you know, we've got you and I talked about a couple of topics that we're going to go over, some things that some people simply have never heard before, and I love our lineup of topics. So to prevent any more further delay, let's go ahead and start off with introducing yourself and let us know a little bit about what you want to share today.
All right. Well, my name is Michael McCulloch, and I'm the grandson of Robert P. McCulloch. He had four children. Robert P. McCulloch Jr., who was my uncle, Richard McCulloch, who was my dad, and then Mary and Barbie, who were my aunts. Unfortunately, Barbie's the only one that's still alive. The other three are no longer with us. But anyway, so yes, I'm the grandson of Robert P. McCulloch. I have a home in Lake Havasu. I've been going out there since probably, I don't know, 1963, when there really wasn't much out there other than Site 6. In fact, the first time I came out there, we stayed at the little apartments above Site 6. I know you had asked me a little bit about some of the other ventures that my grandfather had. He was an inventor since pretty much day one. He majored in engineering in college. Right out of college, he started a company called McCulloch Engineering. They made racing engines, superchargers, that type of thing, which he was probably in his early 30s when he sold that company for $1 million to BorgWarner, so that would have been like in the 40s. And then from there he went to McCulloch Aviation. I think some people probably are aware that they built aircraft. They provided a lot of aircraft parts and aircraft for during World War II. And then he saw an opportunity in small engines and moved into converted McCulloch aircraft into McCulloch motors. And they made a lot of different types of small engines. And then eventually he kind of came across the small handheld chainsaw. And that's what, outside of Lake Havasu, that's the thing that he is most famous for, and most successful, actually, because that was a company that he eventually sold to Black & Decker. And around about that same time is when he got into land development. Lake Havasu was his first development, and he kind of stumbled upon Havasu. He was looking for a place to test his outboard engines because that was another division of McCulloch Motors. One opportunity he had was in the Salton Sea. Another was in Havasu. Part of the challenge was he needed to buy some of the land at Havasu, and he thought, well, what am I going to do with this? Once he spent a little bit of time out there, he realized how beautiful Havasu was, ended up buying some more land. I think totally it ended up being about 17,000 acres, then decided to build a beautiful city there. So with the success of that, he moved on to some other communities. Most of them had a gimmick, but, you know, the biggest gimmick for Havasu was the London Bridge. And I think you'd ask me, you know, I've heard a lot of stories about how they came across that, and I don't know what the real story is. I know what I had heard was that C.V. Wood, who was the president of McCulloch Oil, which was another company that my grandfather had, there was a division of McCulloch Oil called McCulloch Properties, and that's the company that built, you know, the Lake Havasu and some of these other developments like Pueblo West and Fountain Hills and Silver Lakes, which is in California. But anyway, in Havasu, he had Woody involved with trying to develop a town. Woody had a background with, he was one of the master designers of Disneyland. So they, you know, I think initially they saw Lake Havasu as a retirement community opportunity. And so anyway, since C.B. Wood was actively involved with it, the story that I had heard was that C.B. Wood was in New York. And I've heard two different versions. One version I heard was he was with my grandfather, and they saw an advertisement for the London Bridge. Another story that I heard was that he was there with another business associate, And then they, you know, somewhat late at night had seen the advertisement for the London Bridge, called my grandfather and said, we got to buy this thing. And I think my grandfather said something like, why don't we talk about it in the morning? Because his assumption was that C.B. Wood had been drinking a little bit. Anyway, he wasn't drunk, and they started talking about it further and realized that if they could find a way to get that bridge and move it out to the desert, it would be, I mean, that would be amazing. So they made an offer on it. I think their offer was based on kind of what they thought it would be worth, and then a little bit what it would cost to dismantle it, and also a little bit of what maybe the City of London would be happy with as far as a profit. And then for an extra added measure, they threw in $60,000. So they made an offer of $2,400,000 and $460,000. The $60,000 represented my grandfather's age. I believe it would have been his age when that bridge opened. So here's the other thing that, Dan, you and I talked about. And actually, people can Google it and look it up if they haven't read it. But the BBC did a really, really interesting article on my grandfather that came out, I want to say it was last September. And it made a list of the top 50 most read articles across the board. I mean, and whether it's CNN or BBC or Time, any of those online articles, I mean, it even got more coverage than the royal wedding. So, in that article, one of the things they really wanted to ask about was this idea that a lot of people in London think that they bought the wrong bridge. And I actually was in London doing a tour, a kind of a jet boat tour of the Thames, and that's the story they tell. They go bridge by bridge, and then when they get to the current London Bridge, they tell the story of the old London Bridge that was purchased and moved to Arizona, but that the people who bought it actually thought they were buying the Tower Bridge, and that is just not true. And you know, the City of London, it would have made them look like they pulled a fast one, the Americans. So they have always denied it because they're so proper, and you know, they don't want that kind of reputation. My grandfather and my uncle and C.B. Wood and some others that were involved with it, they didn't really do too much to dispel that myth, because every time it came up, they got more publicity. But the reality is, you know, they think that they got the wrong bridge and they intended to buy the Tower Bridge, which is, if anybody's been to London and seen it, it's a huge bridge that operates. It opens up in the middle. It allows ships to pass through. It's got two very large towers on either end. That's not something that I don't think anybody in the right mind would be able to figure out how to take apart and, you know, ship through the Panama Canal and bring to Long Beach and over to Lake Havasu like they did with the original London Bridge.
Wow. You know, that's such a great myth buster. I'm so glad you shared that with everybody, because we can finally put that one to bed. You know, I even found that in the Guinness Book of World Records where they basically agreed exactly with what you're telling them. So, you know, there's a couple things here that a couple topics we need to touch on, and we'll have a break here shortly. But you know, one of the things that I wanted to touch on was that there were a couple of other items that McCulloch put together, and I think you mentioned a car, and we were talking about the MC-4 helicopter.
Yeah, he did helicopters. He had the little gyrocopter that you know, was kind of a combination between a helicopter and a little small plane. I think he had this vision that everybody could have one in their garage, and you just pull it out and off you go, and they're still trying to work on something like that. He had a car called the Paxton, and it's a really cool-looking car. It kind of looks like maybe a little bit like one of those 57 Thunderbirds, but a little bit more sports car-oriented. And he at one point in time, envisioned, you know, manufacturing them. So he came up with a prototype. It had a Porsche engine in it. And by the way, my grandfather's middle name was Paxton, so that's why some of these companies had the word Paxton in them somewhere. And the car never, he went off in a different direction and decided not to produce the car. So there's, as far as I know, there's at least one. There may be only one that's a prototype that's out there. And the guy that had some involvement with the design of it, somehow that car made its way to him, and then his estate had it, and then it went into a museum for a while. And last I heard is one of the descendants of the guy that designed it still has possession of that car, and he takes it around and brings it to the shows. And it's just a unique one-kind car. But as with a lot of my grandfather's inventions, it was way ahead of its time. So it had a convertible top that would retract and then kind of roll back over the back of the trunk.
Well, that's fantastic. You know, that's something I know that most of us had not heard before. And, you know, as we get closer to our break here, I wanted to touch on one little, one extra thing. We talked about the Corvair story a little bit. And when, basically they'd bought up all the Wagoneers from Jeep, ran out of vehicles and needed more. And you and I kind of touched on that when he went to the Corvair Corporation.
Right, and I think what he had, the Corvair was kind of new at the time, and he had basically asked them to customize some sort of a vehicle that would be appropriate for taking all these people that come off the airplane. And by the way, I think most people, I'm sure probably a lot of people that are listening on this call that were part of those flights that came out from the Midwest. You know, free flights, go out to Havasu, go out there in, you know, October or whenever it's the most beautiful, and they got wine and dined and treated to the trip out in the lake, and then signed and bought their lots and their homes and that type of thing. But they also needed to transport some of the people around, either from the airport to the lake or whatever else. So these, my recollection is these Corvairs, they had a fleet of them, were, you know, kind of like large golf carts is the best way that I could describe it, with a kind of a, they were pink, and they had this canvas top on them that was striped pink and white. And
okay.
Michael, well, we've got to make a break here real quickly. Okay. Hang in there for just a second, and we'll be right back to you, okay? We want to give away some tickets to the Arizona Cardinals game tomorrow night at State Farm Stadium with the Chargers. You can give us a call at 855-9336 right now and get tickets. There's four tickets in the lower level, and you got a parking pass and everything else. Give us a call, 855-9336. Speak Out is brought to you by Patio Paradise, Sun Power by Esme Electric, Sam Shooter's Emporium, Shagru's Family of Restaurants, Herb's Herbs, Mills Brothers Furniture and Sleep Center, and Realty Executives, Lake Havasu City. We're back with Michael McCulloch, and we also have Dan DeLosantos here on the Havasu Pioneer Hour here on KNTR Talk.
Well, we're back with Michael McCulloch, and he's certainly shared some really interesting information with us today. You know, Michael, one of the things that you and I talked a little bit about, and I was looking back, looking into a little bit of history, and, you know, there was comment to be made that Bob had basically tripled his investment in 72 hours at the time of the inauguration of the bridge, and, you know, that I just find that just amazing for any entrepreneur to be able to accomplish that.
Yes, and, you know, and I had heard something similar to that as well. And, you know, when they had that grand opening of the bridge in 1971, of October 1971, there was an unbelievably huge turnout for that. And, you know, once again, it was October, so the weather was great. They had a ton of people out there, and my understanding, and you and I had talked about this, was, you know, they had the salespeople out there in full force, and they couldn't sign up people fast enough to purchase lots and buy homes and, you know, make Havasu either their second home or where they're going to move to retire or just move there permanently. But, yeah, all that investment definitely paid off. And it's, you know, the bridge still looks wonderful, you know, 50 years later, or almost 50 years later, in its new home in Lake Havasu.
So, you know, one question I think a lot of folks are asking, where's the McCulloch Company today? What's up with the family? What is there anything new that we want to hear about, or help us out?
You know, in the 70s, they sold Chainsaw Company to Black & Decker. And then it changed hands a few times, and now it's currently owned by Husqvarna, which was a competitor in the chainsaw business a long time ago. I don't know if they really, you know, they kept the McCulloch name, but they manufacture things that are a little bit different, not necessarily the chainsaws, but, you know, there were some leaf blowers and some lighting systems, that type of thing. But unfortunately, yeah, it's no longer in the hands of our family, and you know, the legacy, I think the number one legacy for that my grandfather has now is Lake Havasu, the London Bridge. Most people, if you mention Lake Havasu, they either have heard of it or they know that the London Bridge is there. You know, and that generation above me, my father, my uncle, one of my aunts, they've passed away. And so what's left there's six grandchildren, and we all kind of do our own thing. My sister and I are very active with Lake Havasu. We own the marina there. spend a lot of time out there. A lot of my cousins come out and bring their kids and do, you know, the lake stuff and come and, you know, just check out the town. But, yeah, a lot of those initial companies that my grandfather owned are no longer around, other than the Motors Company, which is owned by Husqvarna.
Wow. Well, you know, the first thing I'm going to say is, hey, Michael, I need a slip. You know, if for anybody that's in Colorado, we talked about Pueblo West real quick. You know, if you go to Pueblo West, you know, you're going to, what's going to be really interesting is you're going to be on McCulloch Boulevard. I thought that was really interesting to be able to be out there and have it drive right down to the marina and get into the Pueblo Lake there.
Well, the other thing, too, I'll say is if anybody's seen Fountain Hills, it's out a little bit east of Scottsdale. And, you know, Lake Havasu, their gimmick is the London Bridge. And in Fountain Hills, their gimmick is the largest fountain in the world, which if you go into Guinness Book of World Records, it's there twice. One for having the largest fountain in the world, and two for owning or purchasing the largest antique. I don't know if that's still the case, but they call the London Bridge an antique because it got around taxes for by doing so. But Fountain Hills is... Fountain Hills is a very beautiful community, and that fountain goes off every hour for 5 minutes on the hour, assuming the wind isn't too strong. But it's also a beautiful community.
Well, Michael, I can't thank you enough for being on with us today. You know, it's really special, and certainly we really owe an amazing amount of gratitude to you and the family for helping create the town that we all live in and appreciate today. So, you know, with that, certainly I hope to see you soon, and we'll probably bring you back on with a couple of other topics that we'll have as we go through the season.
That sounds great. Well, Dan, thanks so much for having me on.
Wonderful. I appreciate that, Michael. Talk soon.
All right, thanks.
Okay, Michael McCulloch. Yeah, interesting. That was interesting, Dan.
Okay. So our next speaker up will be Mona Powaka.
Now, she's going to call in, too.
She is. She's going to be calling in here any moment. And she is the representative to the Hopi and Hualapai tribes during the bridge dedication. And so she's going to be calling in, and she's got something kind of interesting to share with you because she was there during the inauguration and when they put in the time capsules to the London Bridge, which are underneath a very large stone. There are actually two sets of time capsules, and she represented the Hopi and Hualapai tribes, and we had other representatives for the Shimawavy and other reservations nearby. So we're hoping that she'll call in any moment, and we do anticipate that. So, Kevin, any input there?
Well, I'm just really surprised by all the information that Michael had to bring to this this show today. Unbelievable.
I was really taken by that. You know, there's certainly a lot of information we don't know about the McCulloch family and some of the holdings and projects that Bob did over the years. And it's just fascinating to hear all the interesting stories that we didn't know about.
Well, you know what? We're going to go ahead and take this break. It's maybe a little sooner than normal, but we're going to go ahead and take this break, and then we'll come back, and then Mona will be back with us, I would figure.
It's
okay?
On.
Before we go, I got something information. Family Law Assistance Project is going on at the courthouse from 1 to 4 p.m. today. 928-681-1177 is the number to call. And coming up on Thursday, a conversation with Joe at the London Bridge Resort Convention Center at 5:30 in the afternoon. Speaker is Joe Trujillo. He's the first responder at the towers at the New York City in the 9/11 event back in 2001. Okay. Yes, we do have a call. We do have the call. Let's go ahead and go get it. Hello, Mona. Are you there? Are you there, Mona? No? I guess she's not hearing. Okay, we're going to go ahead and we'll take the break. We're back on Speak Out Now, and Dan DeLosantos is here. And we have our caller who is called in. This is Mona. Hello, Mona. Are you there?
I'm here.
Hi. Hi, Mona. It's really good.
Hi there.
Hi. Thank you so much for calling in. And so we gave you kind of a quick introduction earlier, and let folks know that you were present during the celebration and dedication of the London Bridge, and we'd like people to tell, we'd like you to tell everybody what you did.
Okay. Well, I was a member of the Colorado River Hostess Club, and those were some of our members that were there at this event. It was to put these time capsules into one of the cornerstones of the London Bridge.
Wow. So tell us, what was underneath that stone?
What we put in there were little items that represented the Colorado River Indian tribe. Each girl represented the four different tribes: the Mojave, Chemehuevi, Hopi, and Navajo.
Wow.
And so each one of us had an item that was put in there on behalf of... one vial that had, I believe it was cotton seed, and then we had a vial of water from the Colorado River, and a turtle, pottery turtle, and then I believe it was a Navajo jewelry, turquoise.
Wow, that's I'll tell you, folks, what's really nice to hear about that is that for all of us that won't be here in another 50 years, we won't have to wait to find out what's going to be in.
When are they supposed to open the capsule? Do you know?
I have no idea. Maybe has 100 years passed?
Not yet.
not even close, yeah. But it's coming up on 50 pretty soon.
Actually, if I'm not mistaken, because of when they put it in, it was before the bridge was dedicated. And so when they were there to put that in the stone, it was, I want to say, April 4th of 1970. So if they stick to the 100 years, it'll be 2022.
100 years would be 2070.
Yeah, there you go, 2070. So, that's when it's supposed to happen. And
we won't be here. Definitely we won't be here. That's kind of tough. I would want to see this doggone capsule.
I do too. Well, you know, it turns out there was another set of time capsules put in the bridge also, Kevin. And, you know, that was where Lee Shoblin was present and a number of individuals from the town. And they all put a little something inside there as well. So it's my understanding there's time capsules on each side of the London Bridge.
Oh,
so
yes, there were several others.
So you got to mingle with all the guests that were there at the celebration, and it sounded like you were helping serve and making sure they were all comfortable.
No, that was at other events we participated in, but
okay.
When we were there at Lake Havasu City, we had the opportunity to meet with Mr. McCullough. And there were some pictures that were taken of us with him.
And we're going to have those pictures posted, by the way, on the website. That'll be www.havasupioneers.com. That'll be up and running here shortly.
Good.
And so we'll be able to share those with the general public.
Yes. We also met with, you know, there were other dignitaries there that we had a luncheon with them at, right there by the lake.
Oh, wow. Okay.
It was really nice.
Well, I'll tell you what, Mona, thank you so much for being on with us today, and we'll look forward to seeing you here in the future. And certainly, if we come up with any more topics that involve you in the Hopi tribe, we certainly want to get back with you if that is okay with you.
Yes, I'm part of the Colorado River Indian tribe, so...
Wonderful.
I'm happy to do that.
Well, thank you so much. And now we're going to go on to our next speakers, which is Steve Benoni and Jimmy Tedeschi. And so for them, they're going to be calling in here in just a moment. And so what was life like before the London Bridge? And that's really the big question we want to share with you. And, you know, Steve and Jimmy were some of our early pioneers, that were able to, give us a little description about what life was like back then. And there wasn't much here, right, Kevin?
No, there really, really wasn't. Our family got here in August of 1971, and the bridge was just about completed, but there wasn't any water under it or anything like that. And so it was kind of interesting.
Wow. You know, it, and certainly, I got here in 71 myself. I think I started coming in about 1964, and, you know, that was, you know, there really wasn't much here. Of course, there was no channel. And there was, very little to see. A couple of buildings, a gas dock.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, Havasu Landing was pretty much your resource for fuel and other things.
Okay, well, we do have the call coming in. Let's get it for you. Hello there.
Hello. Hi, Dan.
Hi, Steve. So we have Steve Mannone online with, Jimmy Tedeschi. And so, we want to share with you folks and let Steve tell us a little bit about life before the London Bridge.
Well, Jimmy, you got there before I did. Why don't you go first?
Sure thing. Hey, Danny, nice. The show's great. Really enjoy listening to it. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
I came out in 66. We came from the train to Needles. And when I got there was like... it was great because we didn't need to have money because there was nowhere to spend it. They pulled a store and the Nautical Inn gift shop. So everything was pretty much just, you know, free and living. And so we ended up playing with what we had, which was mostly like rocks and lizards. A lot of cool rocks there, a lot of quartz and petrified wood and stuff, and a lot of cool lizards with the horny toads. And so, you know, at first it was mostly living on the land until, you know, some stores started opening and there started to be places to go.
Oh, my gosh.
It was really beautiful.
How many people were in town when you guys showed up?
Well, when we got there, it was like 400 or 500.
Right.
Wow. That's amazing. What did your kids do? Go ahead, Steve.
In 67, there was about 400 then.
Go ahead.
So when we got there, the road 95 ended at the airport. It just stopped at the end of the airport there. That was it. When we went to Havasu, we drove the cars and we had the old canvas water bags you used to put over the radiators. The cars weren't quite used to the heat back then.
So I imagine that was kind of a new experience running into that kind of a high heat.
Well, you know, for my parents, it sure was. For my brother Mike and I, we were, you know, 9 and 10 years old, and it was like going to the Wild West.
So what did the kids do back then? You know, I recall there was a couple of activities. You know, one of the things that we had talked a little bit about was the Soapbox Derby race.
That was awesome. The Soapbox Derby was awesome. It was a great time to have a little project to put together with your dad and, you know, they were just a great time. I think Jimmy took the first place trophy on that.
Yeah, I got a trophy for the best looking car because I painted it with fluorescent colors. Yeah.
So when those events happened, did kind of the whole town show up for that kind of event?
Absolutely, that was like the only event happening. The whole town,
right.
Like a block of people.
That's right.
So it sounds like there was a lot of family time available then. I mean, back then I would imagine you were probably a little more active with family entertainment, maybe fishing, camping. How did that go for you guys?
Well, I know what my – go ahead, Jimmy.
Yeah, we did a lot of exploring, Danny. Like you, Mike, and Steve, one time we took our mini bike, tried to drive to Parker on our mini bike down Old Parker Road.
Yeah.
About halfway, and the chain broke, so we had to – tow a mini bike back with our belts.
Yeah,
a lot of adventures, and you know, like I said, it was an amazing opportunity. And McCullough used to do a lot of cool things for the people for free. Like there was a Easter egg hunt at the sod farm. There was a Santa gifts at the rec hall and stuff. So a lot of times there'd be something in town you'd go to that's totally free that, that everyone would show up for, and it was really great.
So when did you guys first hear about the London Bridge coming to Lake Havasu?
Remember that, Jimmy?
Yeah, I was living on Sunflower, and I saw the fence go up, and they started bringing rocks in. And we were asked, like, what's that? And someone said, oh, they're bringing the London Bridge. And nobody believed it at the time. You know, they're like, that's impossible. There's no way, you know.
I remember looking at each other going, yeah, sure.
Right. We put the sign up, though, and then filled the compound with the big rocks. And it was like, oh, this is really happening.
So how many, there wasn't a lot of businesses there. What are some of the first businesses you can recall that stand out that might even still be there today?
Well, Claypool's, but that's not there any longer. That was our only grocery store, and they used to bring the newspapers in from Phoenix about 4 in the morning, and the newspaper boys, we'd be there at 4 a.m. waiting to fold those papers up. That was like the biggest thing that happened all week long. Now, the boat races, though, the Outboard World Championship, I believe that started in 66, and that was always a huge event.
Wow, so everybody just showed up with campers, I'm assuming, because there were no real hotels and things.
Well, the Nautical Inn was out there.
That's true.
And,
the Nautical and Wings Motel, and then Jimmy's dad and mom and my parents built the Flying Carpet Restaurant, which was a long-standing restaurant right next to Wings there, and all the boaters would come in, and it was an awesome time. As a matter of fact, one of the menus for the Flying Carpet is in that 100-year time capsule.
Okay. All right. Hey, Jim and Steve, stay with us. We're going to make our last break of the hour, so we're going to be right back, okay?
All right, then.
All right. And let me make this break, and we'll be back right after this. Speak Out is brought to you by Bradley Chevrolet, Ford, and Lincoln, by Springberg McAndrew Financial Services, Horizon Community Bank, Connected Computer and Technology, GDK CPA LLC, the Better Business Bureau, and Kingman Force on Force. We're back with Dan De Los Santos, along with Jim Tedeschi and Steve Manoni on the line.
So Steve and Jimmy have been sharing some really great history about Havasu before the London Bridge, and so I want to bring them back on and let them share a couple of other stories that they have for us about life in Lake Havasu in the early 60s. Go ahead, Steve and Jim.
Well, I'd like to say, first of all, that growing up in Lake Havasu City was the most awesome childhood a kid could ask for. So much fun with the lake and the motorcycles and the horses, which we didn't even talk about. But I would like to mention, I thought it was kind of a funny story, is my dad's first job out there. Now, my dad was a tile guy, tiled most of the town in those years. But when we first got there, he went and took a job at the bowling alley. I think it had 6 lanes, and he was a bartender, and he was earning $1 an hour. And I think after like 3 weeks, he asked for a 10-cent raise, and he got fired. Might have had something to do with lighting the lizard on fire on the bar. Those were some great days.
So talk to me a little bit about Day of the Wolves.
Oh, Day of the Wolves, man. When Pretty Girl Faye Jr. came into town to make that picture, it was like one of the most exciting things. And I know that when they had the auditions for the part of the kid, Will, which is the part that I got, and I don't know, the guy just liked the way I said a line, but what a great experience that was, and those 3 days in that film, it allowed me to buy my first Honda 70.
Wow, and that's a big thing, you know, today to be able to go out and get a vehicle like that, an off-road vehicle, and go out and do whatever you want to do, I mean, those were the days to be able to just get out there and go.
Oh, it was great. Great. No law enforcement to worry about. All the desert. And, boy, did it teach us how to ride.
And by 7th grade, we were all riding our motorcycles to school. We'd all park across the street behind Harmon's paint store with our bikes. It was pretty cool. But one time, Steve and I, while they were building the bridge, we found, like, a little opening so we could squeeze through on our bikes. So we drove our motorcycles in, and we drove under the London Bridge. We wanted to be the first ones to drive under it while they were still building it. And we got back, and Steve called KFWJ and told them what we did. And then they announced on the radio that it's pretty funny. They announced that Steve Manoni and Jim Tedeschi drove motorcycles under the London Bridge. And before that, they'll receive a visit from the sheriff's department. So we got all scared that the sheriff was going to come get us next. But he was just kidding.
That was Lee Shelburne, yeah.
So you guys were there, of course, when everybody started showing up. And so tell me, where did they all come from?
All over the country, you know. I mean, the weekenders were California, but, you know, the people that were moving there, those turboprops were, you know, bringing people from all the big cities. And, of course, we came from the Midwest, the Chicago area, and it seemed like most of the people were coming from around the Midwest area a lot.
Wow. So McCulloch actually had five Constellation airplanes that were bought up from TWA when it closed up, and they gave free plane flights and vacations to all these people to come in and check out what Lake Havasu was all about, right?
Yes. Yeah, it was awesome. Well, my uncle, Jimmy's dad, went the year before, and he said, I'm moving. And then my mom, thank goodness, the next year said, I'm out of Chicago. We're going to Havasu.
So any other, you guys were there when the Blue Angels flew over, right?
Oh, yeah.
Tell us about that real quick.
Oh, it was so exciting. You know, I just saw them on TV on 4th of July, and they were just as amazing then as they are now. Just incredible performance. And me, Mike, and Steve were walking across the desert to their house, and they flew right over us and scooped down about 30 feet above us.
And you see the pilot
coming out of their jet. Yeah,
the remember, pilot. Jimmy? We saw the pilot,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Well, what happened also in Havasu is that the air was so thin that the pilots had to fly a lot lower. And so I can tell you, it was one heck of a show.
So, you know, in the early years, there was a little bit of entertainment, you know, that showed up in Havasu. You know, some of the, you know, I remember Conway Twitty. We even had a concert where the Beach Boys showed up, but the tickets had the wrong dates. And we had all these amazing performers out there at Sarah Park, and nobody showed up. So there was 100 of us sitting out in front of the stage and listening to all these amazing bands, and there was nobody there.
I remember Golden Earring came through one year. One of the campsites down there, Crazy Horse. And that was pretty cool.
Wow, so Crazy Horse, now that was the campground that was out on the island and still there today. And so did you see a lot of people come in on the weekends?
Crazy Horse got built up a lot, huh, Jimmy?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that was like one of the biggest campgrounds in the whole area there. So everybody was hitting on Crazy Horse. And they brought the water slides in a few years later. And it's a pretty cool place.
That's fantastic.
I do remember going to church at Site 6 in the early years, and they would have, like, the Baptists at 7 o'clock, the Catholics at 8 o'clock, and so on throughout the hours. And, Jim, you probably remember, we were sitting back, bored out of our minds, but in those years, they still had the tile floor down, and each tile had a star in the middle. So we would peel off a part of the floor, and we would break the tile to make the star shape. By the end of one summer, there was no more tile in the back of that church.
Well, it sounds like life was pretty exciting back then. You know, I realized that you had to be pretty resourceful and find your own things to do. You had to be innovative to go out and find everything out in the desert. You know, you guys probably got to explore Rip's Ranch and some of the neat places that, you know, we don't see much left of them anymore.
Man, Rep still had everything was there. I mean, there was still newspaper flowing there from the old days. I mean, it's unfortunate that people take things and things get torn down, because that was really quite a place to go and see back then. Now you can't even tell was he ever there.
So Site 6 was basically the landing spot for the Air Force, and it was a makeshift airport for them. And so how many buildings were out there? I mean, a lot of that was still there from when they were present, right?
Jimmy, what do you think?
Yeah, there wasn't really much. The marina and the rec hall is all I really remember when I was there.
Yeah, the one section with a few rooms,
yeah.
The dock, and then that one rec hall that we did the church, and that's all I remember.
And that's the trailer park. But I think there was a lot of buildings before that, so I think we're gone by the time we got there.
Yeah.
What were the hot spots for the adults, by the way? I mean, was it like Crazy Ed's and, you know, maybe the Frigate? I mean, were those some kind of the nightlife for some of the people?
The Frigate? Yeah, that was in Crazy Ed's. That's a long time back, that's for sure. Yeah, that was awesome.
Wonderful. Well, guys, I can't thank you enough for being on with us today. You know, we sure appreciate you sharing some of those stories with us. I know a lot of people didn't know many of the things that you shared with us. And, again, thank you for calling in today. And we'll certainly probably touch base with you folks later on during the season if we have some more topics that you were involved with.
Thanks so much, Gary. Thanks for having us.
You bet, guys. Thank you.
Great show. Thank you.
All right.
So, you know, we want to kind of dedicate this show to a couple people we've lost here recently. This is our first show. We're kind of feeling our way around the studio time and our guests. So I want to dedicate this show to Butch Wood. I want to dedicate it also to Mel Scarborough and Lance Larson, who recently passed away, and some really great pioneers that will be missed. And look for our next show. Our next show is going to have some really great topics, right, Kev?
You're darn right. I mean, I've looked at some of them, and it's unbelievable. All of the things that we're going to talk about.
So stay tuned for the next show. It'll be the first Wednesday of the month at 11 a.m.
September, right.
Excuse me, in September, right?
That's
right. September. And that'll be on 106.3. And you can also catch us streaming live and also a recorded version of the show on www.KNTR.com. And so, and if you're on our Facebook page and you've lived here before or have a property here today, you can get in on the Facebook page for Havasu Pioneers. Also look for the website, www.HavasuPioneers.com.
All right. Dan DeLosantos, great to have you here.
Thank you, Kevin. It was really great partnering with you today.
It's been fun listening to all the stuff that was going on.
You know,
spectacular.
As we go through these shows, you're going to hear more and more things that you've never heard before, or you're going to be reminded of some of those really special times that you experienced back in Havasu.
Speak Out 2.0 with Larry Tuneforce is next up on KNTR Talk 106.3. Fox News is at the top of the hour. Thanks for listening today. Have a great afternoon. We'll be back tomorrow at 11 a.m. Brian Springberger will be here.